Good morning, sir. Mayor, would you please state your name and ADC number for the record?
Christopher Vail, 152882.
Mr. Vail, you appear before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency inasmuch as we have received your application for a Phase 2 hearing today. As you may recall, you were not on the phone or you were not seen in Phase 1, but the board voted to move you to Phase 2, and that's why we are here this morning for your Phase 2 hearing. The board will make a determination whether to send a recommendation to the governor to commute or reduce your sentence, and therefore we will be seeking information from you, and if you have an attorney, as well as your supporters, and we will also be seeking information from the victims and from prosecutors if they are present. So we just wanted you to be aware of what we're doing this morning. Do you understand that, sir?
Yes, sir.
And as you can see, there are three board members participating in your hearing this morning. And they are to my left, which would be to your right, is the Honorable Mr. Michael Johnson. To my right, which would be your left, the Honorable Mr. Louis Kiwanis. My name is C.T. Wright. I am board chair, and I am serving as your panel chair this morning. I am going to provide some information, sir, and if you would correct me where you feel necessary, and then we're going to get back to you. We're going to give you an opportunity to speak, or if you have an attorney, to speak on your behalf, and then we will ask you questions, and then we'll have your supporters to speak at that time. Based upon the information that I have gleaned, and sometimes it's right, sometimes it's incorrect, you're currently serving one sentence, and that is for kidnapping. And you received a 10-year sentence for kidnapping, and you are requesting a reduction of 3.5 years based on information that we have. Based upon information that we have, your CSED is listed as October 19, 2025. Your ERC date is listed as April 7, 2022. And if the governor saw fit to grant your request, you would your sentence would end on April 2nd, 2019. So far, sir, is that information correct?
Yes.
I will also take note that you were also serving a sentence for, I believe it was sexual abuse. That was a 14-year-old sentence, and that sentence has expired. Is that your information as well, sir?
Yes.
Okay. I do take note that you have presented to the board a progress report, and we thank you so very much for this progress report. And I'm just going to ask a few questions about that before we move on further. I do take note that you have had a number of programs and counseling, and based on what I have gleaned from your application, that the last time you participated in a program would have been in 2016. Have you participated in any programming or counseling since 2016, sir?
No, sir.
Okay, and why not, sir?
They say it's it's based on availability, like priority. They said since I've been in prison already so long, I completed most of the major programs that goes to the priority inmates.
Okay, sir. So you have not had any programs since 2016. I think in 2016 you had cognitive thinking for change as well as refrigeration. Is that correct? Those are the last ones that you participated in. Am I correct, sir?
Yes, sir.
Now, just for the record, have you had anything dealing with reentry into the community? Have you had any programs or counseling at all as it relates to that? If you are released, how you know what would happen in the community, so forth. Have you had any programs like that, sir?
I'm not eligible for reentry until I have 2 years left on my current sentence.
Okay, sir. I also take note, as I stated earlier, and we'll talk about this a little later, that one of the offenses that you served time for, you've been incarcerated for, was sexual assault. Have you had any programming, counseling at all dealing with sexual education, anything of that nature, sir?
No, sir.
No programs at all, sir, in that area. Is that because they were not available, or you just didn't want to participate in those type of programs, sir?
They haven't been available. If they were offered, I would take them.
Okay, sir. I also take note that your release plan said that you would live with your family, and I see you listed your mother, your father, your sister, or any of your aunts or uncles. Would that still be your plan if you were released, or when you were released? Is that still your plan, sir?
Yes, sir.
So which one would be the priority? Because you have three or four different ones listed. So which one is your priority? It's your mother, father, aunt. Who would you really be planning to reside with, sir?
My mother.
Okay. And I do take note that your mother is in the room at this time. I also take note that you show that you would, that your mother would help to get you employment at a grocery store. Is that still your plan, to work in a grocery store if you are released, sir, or when you are released, sir?
Yes, sir.
And why do you think that that's why, and we can ask your mother later, but why do you think that's why that she selected that type of employment for you, sir?
She currently works at that at the grocery store, but I'm creative, I like to build stuff, so, you know, whatever job opportunity that are available for me, that's what I would like to pursue, but if she could offer a job immediately, that's what I would do upon my release.
Okay, sir. I further take note, sir, that as it relates to discipline, according to what we see, you did have two disciplines in 2016, but they were dismissed. One was for horse playing, the another one was conspiracy to commit. So they were dismissed. Do you have an idea why they were dismissed, sir?
The conspiracy was a case of mistaken identity. Due to an investigation from the investigators in the prison, they determined I had nothing to do with it. And then the horse play, just, you know, playing around with one of my friends, you know, it wasn't as serious as they had made it, but I take responsibility for the horseplay.
Okay, sir. And I also take note that in 2014, there were a couple of ones that were not dismissed. The one was conspiracy to commit. This is 2014 to be exact, July 30th, 2014, conspiracy to commit, and you were found guilty at that time of a major. Do you remember what that one was all about, sir?
Yes, I was involved. I take full responsibility for it.
What were you involved? What were you doing, sir?
Excuse me?
What were you doing? You say you take full responsibility. What were you doing that you took full responsibility for, sir?
I was in a fight.
You were in a fight. Okay. So did you instigate the fight, or what happened? What happened, sir?
Me and him had prior arguments from years back, and we finally were on the same unit, and I guess we felt that our problems wasn't solved yet.
Okay. Let me just ask this. Some of the questions that I asked, I already know the answer, but I would like to ask at any rate. Since then, since 2014, have you had any programming dealing with anger management at all? Because this did involve anger in as much as a fight took place. So did you have any, have you had any programming at all as it relates to anger management, sir?
I think I was in cognitive restructuring, but I was moved from unit, so I didn't get to complete it.
Okay, sir. Let me just ask this. If you were to run into that individual again, whether while you're incarcerated or on the outside, would y'all have another fight, sir?
No, sir. I ran into the inmate recently, and we have no problems.
Okay, so you saw the problems after 2014, after that fight, after disorderly conduct. And I also take note that same year, I guess that would have been February the 13th, 2014, disorderly conduct, and that one you were found guilty of a minor. Do you remember what happened back on February 13th, 2014, when you had this disorderly conduct? And you were found guilty of a minor at that time, sir. Do you recall that, sir?
I think I do. I think that I was involved in an officer, and it was dropped down to a minor due to the fact that the disciplinary hearing officer realized that what the officer said that I did not do, so they dropped it down to a minor ticket.
Okay, sir. Now, I want to go to your application just very briefly, the application that you submitted, and basically taking this information from what you submitted to the board in the application itself. And you listed, I'm kind of combining the purpose as well as whether the sentence was excessive, but what you indicated in your application that the reason that this board should make a recommendation to the governor should honor the recommendation of this board. You indicate that at the time that the offense was took place, that you were at the age of 14, that your father was in prison for drugs at that time, your mother was a drug addict at that time, that you were trying to fit in with others at that time, and you thought that you would get something like 7 to 12 years sentence, and then you go on to state that since then, and we can get further information a little later, that your mother and father were rehabilitated, and that one of the persons who had the greatest influence on you was your aunt. So is any of that information correct or incorrect, or did I misinterpret what you supplied to the board, sir?
It's all correct, sir.
Okay. And I just want to know, just because you did show there, and I didn't see an explanation that at the time that when you were 14 and this incident took place, that both your mother and your father was, your father rather, was incarcerated, and that your mother was a drug addict. But now I take note that you wish to reside with your mother. So how did you make up with your mother, since that what happened as it relates to your mother? Because at that time, she was a drug addict, according to your application, not according to anybody else's, but that's what you placed on your application. So what has happened there that bring you, the two of you, closer together, sir, as well as with your father?
Well, over the years, you know, she rehabilitated herself. She became clean. And like I said, my aunt Gordon, she passed away. She was a big influence on my life and you know, showed me unconditional love. So as I got older, as I became an adult, I understand what my mom and dad went through with the struggles that they went through. And, you know, my mom and my dad cleaned themselves up. And my auntie gave me the opportunity to reconnect with my mother. And over the several years, me and my mother have become close and, you know, built that bond back together.
Okay, and so about what time did you and your mother come back together? I mean, you know, was it 5 years ago, 10 years ago, last year? When did the two of you decide to kind of use my word now to make up and to work with each other and to talk with each other, and you discovered that she had been rehabilitated? When did that happen, sir?
I think it's been about 7 years now.
Okay, sir. When the last time your mother visited you at the facility, sir, at your unit?
November 4th.
November 4th of this year?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so that would have been, I guess, last week. Am I correct, sir?
Yes, sir.
Has your father visited you recently, sir?
I think it's been a few months.
Okay. And you indicate that your aunt, the one that you had reviews, growing reviews, that she has deceased, so she is no longer alive. Am I correct, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I also take note that you stated that you were expecting a plea, that you were offered, rather, a plea at, from 7 to 12 years. But take note that you did not accept the plea, and the reason that you gave you did not accept the plea was because you didn't comprehend it at the time. Is that correct, sir?
It's not that. It's the same plea. When I signed the plea, my lawyer told me that I was going to get anywhere from 7 to 12 years, and I think they relayed that to some of my family members, and that was the reason I signed the plea, you know what I mean? But it didn't work out like that. I ended up like with 26.
So you signed the plea, and so what happened? You said it didn't work out, so what happened?
Upon sentencing, I was I was maxed out for the assault. I was given 14 years for the kidnapping. I was given 10 years. And then for an attempted, I was given one term of lifetime probation. And I wasn't, when I signed the plea, that's not what my lawyer presented to me and my family.
Okay. And you said, and your family, so what family members was there advising you at that point? Because your mother was an addict and your father was incarcerated, so who was working with you, with the family members that was involved with you at that time, sir?
In the beginning, there was nobody until my Aunt Gwilda and my Uncle Dan. My Aunt Gwilda has passed, but my Uncle Dan and my Uncle Jimmy and my Aunt Carrie, and when they finally found out that I was incarcerated, they came later on, but in the beginning, it was nobody.
Okay, sir. Okay, I'm just going to, just very briefly, and I'm not going into any details because I want you to tell me exactly what happened and tell this board. Don't tell me, but tell the entire board, because this is the first time that we as board members had an opportunity to talk with you to tell us exactly what happened. And I'm going to give just a very, very brief summary from what I have gleaned. And tell me what's right, what's wrong, and then you can give us all kind of explanation for what happened. What I've gleaned from reading the pre-sentence report and the information that you provided to the board, that it was on October 9, 1999, that you went to the victim's house to rob her. She was asleep at the time. You grabbed her, and you wanted her money. She didn't have any money. And then you took advantage of her sexually. I'm just not going to be explicit on that. That might come up later, but you did rape her. And then you took some cigarettes, some jewelry, and $7. You tied her up. You left the house. You went out and bought some drugs. Then you went home and in your room, and the next day, a SWAT team came and arrested you. What I've said so far, what's right, what's wrong about that statement, sir? What's true or what's not true about it?
Everything is true, sir.
So why did you select that house, sir?
I knew her daughter, and I knew the house.
So were you going there when you went initially to the house? I mean, this time, well, the day of the offense, October 9, 1999, did you go there for the purpose of robbing the victim? Why did you go to that house? What was the purpose of you going there, sir?
To rob her, get money so I could buy drugs.
What kind of drugs were you going to buy, sir?
Powder cocaine.
Okay, and how well did you know her? That is the victim. You said you knew her daughter. How well did you know them?
I knew her daughter. I went to school with her daughter, but I didn't know the mother too well.
So you went to the house to get some money to buy drugs. Okay. Of course, I cannot condone that, but here you are. She said, I don't have any money. Why did you rape her, sir? This is a 49-year-old person. You are 14 years of age. Why would you do that, sir?
You know, for the past 18 years, you know, as I became an adult, I think about that, and it makes no sense to me. I don't know if I was, you know, just out of control due to the drug use. But I know what I did to that day. That day was wrong. I've been trying to figure out, you know, how can I express to her, you know, how I hurt her and her family and the terror that I caused her that night. And I was wrong for that. There's no excuses for it. And, you know, I have a mother and sisters and aunties, and I wouldn't want, you know, that to happen to none of them. And, you know, I don't know if sorry is enough, but that's all I could give her, and I'm truly sorry for what I did to her that night. You know, I'm disgusted with myself, and, you know, I deserve to be here. You know, I was out of control, so I deserve to come to prison for that. And, you know, I hope she can forgive me, but I know the pain I caused her.
But why did you do it, sir? The question I'm asking, why did you do it? You went there to get some money. You admit that. You went there to get some money so that you could buy some drugs. So why did you take it to the next step, sir?
I think I was angry because she didn't have no money. And I can't really say there's a reason why I did it, but I knew she didn't have no money when I had asked her for money. You know, she had like $7. So I think I was angry because of that.
Okay, now according to what you said in your application, after this incident had taken place, you went, you bought some drugs, then you went home, locked yourself in the room, and of course police officers came to your home the next day and arrested you. So why did you go home and why did you lock yourself in the room, sir, after you committed this this crime, sir?
I was high. And I was, you know, barricaded myself in the room. I know what I did. I went too far. And I don't know, I just isolated myself.
Did you contact anybody and tell them what had happened? You know, your aunt, your uncle, or any friends? Did you tell anybody what had happened during that period after you went home, sir, and locked yourself in the room?
No, sir. I wasn't in contact with them. Like, really none of my immediate family. My dad was in prison, and then I was living with his wife and her children.
So you were living with... So who were you living with? Tell me again. You just told me, but tell me again. Now, who were you living with at that time, sir?
My father's wife and her children.
So did you tell any of them what you had done?
No, sir.
And why did the police come the next day and arrest you? What happened there? How did they know that something had happened and that you were involved in some criminal activity, sir?
I think the victim recognized my voice, and she knew who I was.
But I mean, under ordinary circumstances, the police would just come, you know, and knock on the door, but they sent a SWAT team there, so they must have known something about you from to go that far, sir. In fact, the term that you use, I believe that they raided the house on the next day. The next day they raided the house.
Yes, sir.
Okay, sir. Now I'm going to yield to some of my board members to see if they might have any questions for you at this time, sir. Board members, the Honorable Mr. Kamanis.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Can you hear me, Mr. Vail?
Yes, sir.
I guess I just have one question, and that is, I think we can agree that you were growing up in a pretty negative environment, at least at that time. You were involved with drugs. Knowing what you know now, what would you have done differently? Knowing what you know now, what would you have done differently as a 14-year-old in that environment?
I think back then it was hard for me to compartmentalize, you know, the struggle that I was going through, but as I know now, I think I would have reached out to other family members that, I don't know the right word. I would have, you know, been able to guide me in a better direction. Because back then I felt I was alone, but I did have family members that I could have reached out to, and I don't know why I didn't do it.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you so very much, Mr. Goins. Honorable Mr. Johnson.
Sir. Can you just tell me, I know you were 14 years old when this happened, but a lot of things were going on with you when you were 14 years old as a juvenile that you displayed a very violent behavior. You got into it with a couple of teachers in school, and at one point in the report it says that you threatened to kill your mother when about the TV, and you picked up a remote control and threw it into the TV. What was your state of mind? What was going on during that period of time? You just didn't care, or what?
I never remember trying to kill my mother, but I know I was angry. I was an angry kid, and I think I just felt abandoned, and kind of alone. My sisters were separated from me. My sisters went to live with my uncle and my auntie, and you know, and that part of my life, I felt abandoned and alone. So.
So,
I was there.
So, sir, at 14 years old, what was the mental state that would cause you to want to sexually assault the victim at that time when you went there? Had you been sexually active before, or I'm just trying to understand the things that occurred that particular evening.
Yeah, I was already sexually active, and I don't think my intentions wasn't to break in her house and rape her. That's what happened. I did it, but my intentions was to go and rob her, and then that's what ended up happening. And as a grown man now, you know, I realize, you know, what I did to her was out of line, and it was wrong. And I realized that when I was a kid, but more so now as a man, that, you know, that I crossed the line.
Okay. So you've said several times that you didn't intend to sexually assault her, but you went in the house to rob her. She was asleep. Why didn't you just go ahead and rob the house? Why'd you wake her up?
Because I wanted the money. I didn't want like appliances and stuff like that. I wanted cash money.
So you didn't look around the house for money?
I did, and I couldn't find none.
Okay, I'm gonna go back to the plea agreement. You did take a plea agreement when you went to court, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
So, you said that the original plea agreement was for 7 years?
Yes.
Instead of the 10 to 14 years, because I was looking at the documentation, it looks like that there was one sentence for 10 years, one for 14 years, and all the other counts were dismissed. That wasn't explained to you when you took the plea agreement, or can you?
Yeah, I was told I would get my presumptive on the sentence, and I think the presumptive was 7 years, and then the presumptive on the kidnapping was 5 years, and that's where the 7 to 12 years became. That's what I was told, but that I guess they would end up running consecutive sentencing. And then I was maxed out on both counts, but I was told that I would receive my presumptive of the sentence.
Okay, so the you signed the plea agreement. Is that what the plea agreement you signed said, sir? I was looking back through here to see if I could find it, but I don't see it in here though.
Was this the 7 to 12, sir?
Yes, what did it? Yes, sir.
It had the sentencing guidelines in the plea agreement. The presumptive was 7 for the assault, 2-14, and the kidnapping, I think, was 5 to 12. The presumptive was 5. The maximum was 12. So I guess they could have gave me 7 to 12, but they maxed me out on both counts, which was the max was 14, and then 10 on the kidnapping.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Honorable Mr. Johnson. At this time, I didn't ask you up front, but do you have an attorney representing you in this room at this time, to the best of your knowledge, sir?
No, sir.
Okay, then I'm going to your supporters, and how many supporters do we have? I know that we do have the mother signed in. I don't know who else signed. That's the only one that I have who signed in, so you're going to do. So are you going to speak, ma'am? So would you come forward, please, ma'am? Would you state your name for the record?
My name is Michelle DeBell.
Thank you, and welcome to the board.
Thank you. The last time I came in front of you, I was really emotional. I just want to say I apologize to the family that was affected by this. I got to take responsibility for my actions. Was I the best mom in Bromano? No, I wasn't. And I believe if my life took a different path, my son wouldn't be where he's at today. You know, the lady that was affected in this horrible mistake, you know, my heart goes out to her because I'm a woman too. And I deeply want to apologize. You know, my sister was a big impact on reuniting me and my son. I wrote him for faithfully for a whole year. He never responded to me. And my sister kept telling him, you know, you got to forgive. You know, your mom made a mistake. And one day he reached out, and I've been there with him ever since. Unfortunately, my sister passed away. And I tried to take her footsteps, but there's no replacing her. If I could take back what I've done and the decisions I've made in my life, I would. Because if I would have been a better mom and a better provider and wouldn't be so selfish in what I decided to do, my son wouldn't be where he is, or my daughters wouldn't be struggling with addiction themselves. I really just want to say I deeply apologize for this horrible mistake. And if the victims in this room, I just want to tell her I'm really truly sorry.
You have to speak to the board, ma'am.
I'm really truly sorry. And I just, hopefully you'll find it in your heart, because my son is a grown man now. He thinks totally different than he did when he was 14. Do I know what he was thinking that night? No, I do not. I know how he is today. Do I see him faithfully? Yes. Do I support him? Yes. Am I willing? Have I went through counseling and all of that other stuff that I needed to do to make myself better? Yes. Am I a good citizen today? Yes, I am. And I'm willing to do whatever I needed to do. I went to Flagstaff. I've been in Flagstaff for 10 years. I'm a store manager for Sprouts. I have changed my life. And I try to be a good role model in every which way. The last 4 months, I have transferred down here to get situated so my son can come home and be successful. I've looked into programs and housing and everything that I need to do to make sure that my son is successful. And he does have a great family support. The last hearing that we were at, quite a few of us was here. We just thought it would be, you know, appropriate for just us to be here today to address this situation. And I just want to say thank you for giving us this opportunity to even come in front of you. And I hope you find it and grant him clemency and let him come home. And just thank you.
Thank you. When did you get off of drugs, ma'am? Because, I mean, you know, your son wrote that himself, you know, that you were a drug addict, which sometimes family members are just not that honest, but he actually put that,
you know,
as his writing, not yours, not some other third part.
I'm going to be honest with you, sir. You know, I come from a very dysfunctional family. My mom and dad, you know, both alcoholics, very abusive. I got introduced to drugs before I had my son. I think I was 20 when I had Chris. Got introduced to his dad, Crawford, when I was 13. And back in that time, you know, drug selling, you know, fast car, fast money, you know, that was the way of life. And got introduced to crack cocaine when I was 18 years old. And I took a hit. I was strung out for close to 30 years.
Will you use it and deal in, or just use it?
Just using. I mean, Crawford, that's what he did. I mean, I don't regret my children's, but I do regret meeting him. It changed my life.
What happened to him? I know, I see the word father. Nothing says what happened to him.
You know, Crawford is Crawford. You know, am I going to sit up here and degrade him or badmouth him that I am not? He is my son's father. And whatever he chooses to do with his life today is that's his choice. All I know is I can speak for me and what I've done in my life. Do I still make mistakes? Yes. I've been clean over 10 years. That's why I went to Flagstaff. My mother passed away. And to tell you how deep in my addiction I was, my mother passed away January the 23rd. And I didn't know until May because I was so strung out. And I came home. And I've been home ever since. Am I proud of what I've done? No. From afar. You know, crack cocaine, when it came on the scene, that was the thing. And that's what you did. And here I am today. You know, it's been over 10 years, I believe. It's just not my way of life. I get up every morning and I keep going. And I asked my mom just to guide me. And my sister, it took me a long time for my sister and my brother to accept me back in the family. Come from a really good family. My sister was a supervisor for Maricopa County Health Department. She just died.
I do want to commend you for getting off of drugs and wish you the best. You're being rehabilitated. But I'm going to see if other board members might have questions for you, ma'am.
Okay.
Board members.
I read in here, as I was going back through here, that were you on the bus with him when he was going to court?
Yeah.
How did that happen? Were you going to court for different things or what was going on?
How would a mother feel in the same situation her son is? How would you feel? I was embarrassing. I was disgraced. You know, my son is everything to me. And I made so many mistakes because I was selfish. Because I put my drug use in men and money and whatever I did out there on the streets before I put my own children. And I'm so embarrassed to stand here because my boyfriend's in this room and he didn't know a clue till right now. But you learn from your mistakes and you move on.
It also said that, as far as the plea agreement went, that the mother and father encouraged him to take the plea agreement.
No, I wasn't there. I didn't even know. So, another thing. You know, Crawford's not here today, which I thought was best. My son wanted him here, of course. You know, you weren't here, but you definitely was here the last hearing. And, you know, Crawford, I'm not sure where any of that statement came from when he talked to you. You know, I forgot what he was going to say.
Answer
my mind.
Okay. I was just asking about that. In the report, it says that the mother and father encouraged him to take the plea.
So when this happened, okay, I was doing my thing. Crawford was in custody, and he was living with Edna Crawford's wife. We were all shocked to hear that Edna was on some kind of paperwork. I'm not going to sit here and say somebody else was involved with that somebody else was there with my son, because I don't know. I don't know. All I know is that he's in custody for this crime, and he's admitted to it. And we've talked in depth about this whole situation. And all I know is that none of his family, my family, my sister, my brother, you know, was there till sentencing, because Edna didn't contact nobody. And it was the whole point of this.
Who was it that didn't contact anyone?
Edna. He was staying with Crawford's wife, Edna.
Okay.
My sister or anybody, they didn't know. My mother was still alive at this point. She lived in Arkansas. She had retired. Her and my stepdad moved to Arkansas and stuff. So nobody was contacted on my side of the family. You guys couldn't contact me because I was doing whatever I was doing. Edna is the one that was there with him and told him to go ahead. Now, at sentencing, my sister was there, but it was already too late. It was already too late. Nobody could do anything. He was 14. He didn't know. And I could sit up here and I can blame people, but that's not what we're here for. You know, it is what it is. He signed it. He accepted it, regardless who was there to tell him no, tell him yes. But I truly believe if my sister was there or my brother, which are respectful people. My brother, he's still alive. He's a teacher. He lives in Flagstaff. My son would not be here, or he would still be here, but maybe not having 24 years at the age of 14. You know, he didn't understand. He didn't understand at 14. So that's where all that came about. I'm still trying to figure it out. I wasn't there.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Thank you so much, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else wishes to speak on behalf of Mr. Vela? Anyone else wishes to speak on behalf of Mr. Vela? Anyone else wishes to speak on behalf of Mr. Vela? No one else. Therefore, now we will go to the victim's side. I know that we have attorneys present. I don't know who wishes, or whether family members wish to speak first, so I'm not sure. I'm going to leave that up to those of you who are present who wish to come first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Eric Aiken. I'm an attorney with Arizona Voice for Crime Victims.
And welcome to the board.
Thank you. We represent Ms. Durbin, the victim in the case. I won't be making a statement, but Ms. Durbin would like to read a prepared statement.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, and would you state your name for the record, ma'am?
My name is Phyllis K. Durbin, and I'm the victim in this case. There's a couple of things I want to address first to the board. I owe a debt of gratitude to Sabrina Fisher for finding me. I was not present at the Phase 1 hearing because apparently the address that DOC has on me is incorrect, or it's not a current address. Because of prior actions by family members that took place at the sentencing, I have elected to bring in my own private security team. I have the utmost respect for the board and the DOC officers and the security that's in this building. But due to the situation at hand at sentencing, I do not feel safe. I have to be escorted by deputies out of the hearing room at sentencing because of actions that the inmate's father took against me at that hearing. And I can't even see what I'm reading. I'm a little bit appalled at what happened at the Phase 1 hearing. How his entire family was allowed to get up here and totally trash my reputation and my character that I have spent a lifetime building. I have worked for ATF, City of Mesa, the 911 dispatcher. I worked for the Federal Public Defenders for 8 years. I worked for the U.S. District Court for 16 years. I am square as a square can be. I don't drink. I don't do drugs. I got my first ticket last year, speeding ticket. I am 58 years old right now. This crime happened when I was 40. Nobody can seem to get my age right. I wish you guys would. This whole thing, since it has been resurfaced after 18 years, has thrown my life into total disarray. Distraught. I've lost 10 pounds in the last month. I'm not a big woman. I am tiny. I can't afford to lose that kind of weight. I just survived lung cancer because I beat the odds, and I'm a survivor, and I will always be a survivor, and that's what I taught my daughter. You put on your big girl pants and you suck it up and you get on with your life regardless of what happens. I cannot go into all the details of what happened that night because it's just so traumatic. You have no idea what it's like to be woken up in the middle of the night with an impact on your chest. To have a pillowcase shoved over your head and raped and sodomized. And then when I beg him for a drink of water because I can't catch my air, he walks me out with the pillowcase over my head, cinched up around my neck. And he walks me into a wall and laughs. I was told several times that night that I was going to die. He would kill me. I believed him. Oh, let me just back up a little bit here. I had just gotten out of the hospital. I was in the hospital for 2 weeks because my left lung had collapsed. I had to have major surgery. There were stitches down my side that whatever sharp object he had in his hand, he stuck in those stitches. And you have no idea the pain. Told me if I screamed, if I struggled, he would kill me. And I can assure this board, absolutely 100%, me and the inmate had never had any prior sexual contact. I know that was mentioned at the phase one hearing, and I wasn't going to mention it because I'm just blown away by the allegation. Totally blown away. I had been dating the same man for 10 years during this time. He tied me up and he left my home. And I don't know how I managed, but I wiggled and I crawled across the floor to a phone that I had accidentally left in between the space between the nightstand and the bed, because I had dusted that nightstand during the daytime. And I'd set the phone, this is back in the day when everybody had landlines, I'd set the phone on the floor. And I managed to crawl and wiggle my naked, tied up body over to that phone. And I called 911. The dispatcher is telling me, "Ms. Durbin, there's a police officer at your front door. You can answer your door." I told the dispatcher, "I can't. I'm tied up in my bedroom. I can't move." It was a SWAT team member that had reached my home first. They had to kick down my locked front door to get to me. I lived in a cul-de-sac, and there were like 7 or 8 police cars, the paramedics, fire trucks, and they all came in silent that night because I couldn't tell the officers if he was there or not. They came in with guns drawn. They took me to the hospital, and then they took me to the Chandler Police Station, and one of the detectives asked me if I could do a confrontational call. And I don't know if you're all aware of what that is. That means I call the suspect and I talk about, I ask him questions that they're writing down for me. And I said, I thought I could do it. And I did it. So the inmate did not confess to any detectives. They didn't, you know, pull a rubber hose on him and make him confess to this crime. He confessed to me. What impact has this had on my life? I have a damaged right hip because while he was raping me, he leaned too far in and strained all those muscles across my hip. It cannot be fixed. It gets worse as I get older because I age and nothing is as taut as it used to be when you're young. I have cameras on my home. I have an active security system. I have 2 tiny yappy little dogs that every time they hear a noise, they bark. They're almost as better than my security system. Windows and doors in my home are double checked all the time. You go out there, key door, you lock it. You come in there, key door, you lock it. Front door, permanently locked. Windows, I can tell you every window in my home is locked. Before the inmate left my home, I was sleeping in a waterbed. That's when they were cool. He slashed that waterbed with his something sharp. I had 150 gallons of water running through my home. He did $6,600 worth of damage to my home. There's $3,200 that is due to me for doctor bills, counseling, and time off from work. None of which has been paid to date. And I understand that it's because the way the judgment was written. Because he doesn't have to start paying until after he's released. He told the police that he entered my home through a unlocked front door. Well, I find it extremely ironic when the police arrived to my home, that alleged unlocked front door is now locked. There's your kidnapping, because he prevented me from leaving my home. He tied me up in my bedroom. inmate's been allowed to go to college through Rio Salado, I understand from the corrections, yet he's only received his GED. The inmate has 51 disciplinary tickets, 9 dismissals, and 2 informal resolutions. That leaves 41 on the books for assault with a weapon, rioting, disobeying orders, fighting, giving, receiving tattoos, and selling and trading services. The crime that he committed against me was a heinous act of violence. I am lucky I lived. Even the detective who investigated this crime spoke at my sentencing about how heinous this crime was. And it was more along the lines of a seasoned criminal. His prior juvenile record was 13 referrals to the juvenile department. For disobeying orders, whatever they were. 13 of them between the ages of 11 and 14. When he was arrested, his stepmother said that he was out of control. Well, he was out of control. His violence toward the outside world had escalated, and him raping me was just the next step in the line of his criminal activity. I will always believe that he is a danger to society. He will be older and more dangerous when he gets out. The inmate did not receive an excessive sentence for the crime he committed. He received the maximum sentence allowed by the law at the time of this crime. He could have gone to trial and put everything before a jury, but he chose to take the plea because at trial he was looking at 40 years had he lost. I don't believe that he deserves a commutation. He has received a 15% reduction, and now he's asking for another 3.5-year reduction. To me, he has done nothing while incarcerated to better himself. He is relying on the mercy of this board and the sympathy of the board due to his young age at the time of the crime to make the recommendation to the governor to commute his sentence. He needs to serve the remainder of his sentence, which is 5 years. And here's something I found the other day while I was playing on my phone. I have been broken. I have known hardship. And I have lost myself. I have lost myself, but here I stand, still moving forward and growing stronger every day. I will never forget the harsh lessons of my life. They made me stronger. I thank the board for listening to me and allowing me to make this statement, and I apologize for being so... My daughter told me, no crying, no crying. Well, this is a crime thing. This is a horrendous event that happened in my life. And I think he just needs to serve the rest of his time. Thank you.
Thank
I don't
you.
Know if you have any questions.
Thank you so very much. And don't worry about your emotions. And the questions, board members.
You think you see?
Board members have no questions. Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you.
State your name for the record. Good morning.
Good morning, members of the board. My name is Rebecca Jones, and I represent the Maricopa County Attorney's Office.
Thank you, and welcome this morning.
Thank you. On first blush, this case does have an emotional appeal. A 14-year-old being sentenced to 24 years in prison does, without further consideration, seem like something that warrants further consideration. However, the emotional tug of this case is belied by the facts and circumstances through which the defendant earned himself this sentence. And to be very clear, the responsibility for us being here today for this happening lies solely with the defendant. It is not to blame his mother, it is not to blame his family members. He made the decisions that earned him that 24-year sentence. That sentence imposed was not clearly excessive, and the County Attorney's Office respectfully asks that the board not recommend this case for commutation to the governor. I want to address some issues regarding the plea agreement first. I thought you had a copy, but I understand that you don't. I have a copy. May I approach?
Yes, ma'am.
I only have one, unfortunately.
Okay, may we keep it?
Yes.
Thank you.
The defendant in this case was charged with 8 counts of sexual assault and 1 count of kidnapping. Had he gone to trial and been convicted, given the statutory requirements for these counts, after trial he faced a minimum term of 42 years in the Department of Corrections and a maximum term of 124.5 years in the Department of Corrections. Under the plea agreement, which is before you, the range of the plea agreement was 5.25 years to 26.5 years. So although he did receive an aggravated sentence, he did not receive the maximum permissible sentence under the law, under the plea agreement. And even if he had received an additional 2.5 years, that still would have been well below his trial exposure. The defendant said in his petition, his application to the board, 7 to 12 years. He was told 7 to 12 years. That was addressed here this morning. I want to clarify that issue. This is the only plea that was ever extended to the defendant. And the plea is in writing. The plea does not say 7 to 12 anywhere. The records, the minute entry from the change of plea proceeding indicates that the court covered potential sentences with the defendant, which means that the defendant was advised before the plea was accepted and entered, because it was deferred at the change of plea proceeding until sentencing. So the statement that by sentencing it was too late is not accurate. The plea had not been accepted until sentencing. So at the time of the change of plea, he was informed about the possibilities under the plea. He knew the possible consequences when that plea was accepted and entered, and the decision was ultimately his. The judge conducted the proper colloquy, advised him of his rights, found him to be knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waiving his rights, and accepted the plea at that time. In the phase one hearing, there was discussion about the defendant having no, and this is a quote, understanding of the magnitude of the time he was signing up for. That may or may not be true. There's nothing in the court records to support that being true. The defendant was advised at the time of the change of plea, if not before. However, even if it is true, that does not mean that the sentence is clearly excessive. The sentencing hearing in this case took place on 7/18 of 2000, which means that between the change of plea hearing on February 4th of 2000, there was 5 months during which time the defendant could have withdrawn from the plea. It had not been accepted and entered until the 7/18 date. At sentencing, which was later subject to a post-conviction relief review, that request was denied. The court considered the following mitigating factors: the defendant's age, remorse, lack of parental support, and current support of family members. And I would posit that those are in large part the same factors that the board considered in the phase one hearing in this case. The aggravating factors, however, offset the mitigating factors in this case. The defendant's age was offset by his history. The juvenile history that began in 1994, that in 1996 included criminal damage, disorderly conduct, and domestic violence assault. In 97 was petty theft. 1998 with simple assault, burglary in the second degree, which means an earlier residential burglary was in his history. In 98, aggravated assault, domestic violence, disorderly conduct, simple assault with injury, threatening, aggravated assault on a teacher, probation violation. In 1999, aggravated assault on a teacher, simple assault with injury, probation violation for positive test results for marijuana, and another probation violation. The defendant's age at the time of sentencing, at the time of committing the offense, was offset by the maturity of the offense itself. This was not a brief lapse in judgment. This was not an instant decision and then instant remorse. This was a series of some hours where the defendant had repeated opportunities to assess what he was doing and stop. Instead, he continued his course of criminal conduct. The aggravating factors considered by the court at sentencing were the severity and extreme nature of the offenses, the intense juvenile probation, intensive juvenile probation that the defendant was on at the time he committed the instant offenses, his history of assaultive behavior, his criminal history, the medical condition of the victim, the damage to the victim's property, the fact that the victim knew the defendant as her daughter's friend. And although the defendant has said this morning that he did not know the victim very well, she indicated to the police that she recognized his voice, that he had been in the house at least two times over the previous 8 months, and that he had been to her house four times in the past 2 months before the offense, asking if her daughter was home. So he knew her well enough and she knew him well enough to recognize his voice, even in this extremely traumatic situation. The court also considered the threats of death, the harm to the victim of being bound after being raped on multiple occasions, and in doing so, the court recognized that the victim suffered a separate harm from the kidnapping offense, which justifies consecutive sentencing. The fact that the defendant had absolutely no idea why this happened, which was a statement in the pre-sentence report, the court found on that occasion the defendant to be an extreme danger to the community. There are additional aggravating factors that the court did not consider at sentencing. The defendant's use of a weapon, his drug use during the offense, his gang affiliation discussed in the pre-sentence report, which you have reviewed, correct? Okay. And his diagnosis of oppositional defiant disorder, which is correlated with risk. Also the fact that he committed the offense for pecuniary gain. According to him, that's only his account discusses that this started as a robbery and that he asked the victim for money. Her account to the police, the recitation of facts in the police report and pre-sentence report. And I would note that the defendant's statements in the confrontation call do not support that this was a robbery. Nothing in the record other than his current statements indicate that he entered that house that night with anything other than rape in his mind. Additionally, his Department of Corrections behaviors on an ongoing basis, I would ask the board to consider, and that's been discussed in some detail. Although the purpose of today's hearing is certainly not to retry the case, facts do matter to a certain extent with regards to clearly excessive. Certainly the offenses of kidnapping, the offense of sexual assault can include a wide range of behavior. In this case, the defendant's behavior is squarely in line with the offenses contemplated by those statutes. That kidnapping of backbinding and confining, preventing her from moving was his intent, leaving the home. He did not know how long she would be bound. He did not know when she would be found or whether she would be able to be rescued. The sexual assault, he was charged with 8 counts for 8 different penetrative acts, both of the victim's mouth, vagina, and anus. The defendant spoke this morning in response to Honorable Board Member Johnson's questions about why he did this. And he offered 2 explanations, that he was out of control due to drug use. Drugs don't make people rape. Drugs are disinhibitors, but they don't create the impulse to rape. He also indicated he was angry because the victim didn't have any money, Again, anger does not make people rape. Anger may serve as a disinhibitor, but sexual violence and non-sexual violence are certainly not the same kind of violence. And the defendant, to this day, does not recognize the sexual deviancy underlying this offense. And that makes sense because he has not been treated, he has not engaged in treatment, but an untreated sex offender poses a higher risk of recidivism. A sex offender with no insight into his offending, into the sexual deviancy underpinning his offense, makes him more dangerous. In the phase one hearing, none of the supporters for the defendant discussed why this would be a clearly excessive sentence. And that makes sense because considering the aggravating factors, considering what the court did at sentencing, this isn't a clearly excessive sentence. This is a sentence exactly in line with the defendant's behavior and history. Although the board's decision today is clearly not governed by the same standards as the criminal appeals courts, the Arizona Supreme Court has issued decisions that offer some guidance on the issue of clearly excessive. The proportionality analysis offered by the U.S. Supreme Court, comparing the gravity of the offense and the harshness of the penalty, that's the Ewing case. In making that judgment, the bodies at issue must give substantial deference to the legislature and its policy judgments in statutory mandated sentences. Sexual assault and kidnapping are given some of the strongest mandated sentences under our law. The legislature has a public policy interest in those threats to our community, and the defendant's behavior in this case is squarely covered by those statutes and by the kind of behavior that they are seeking to outlaw. This offense is extremely grave. It is not an offense you would think of as being committed by a 14-year-old. And I would posit that if the board heard these facts without the defendant's age, that we would not be at a phase two hearing. This is an extremely heinous offense. This is a violent offense. This is a dangerous offense. This is an hours and hours of rape and terrorizing a woman who had done nothing other than gone to sleep in her secured home. Although the penalty is harsh, it is not disproportionate, and the fact that the defendant now at the age of 32 would like to work at Sprouts and spend time with his family does not negate that this was a lawful sentence imposed pursuant to a plea agreement that the defendant signed, and it is not really excessive. Are there questions?
Thank you. Questions, board members? I see no questions. Thank you so very much, attorney. And I would also just like to put on the record that we do have a letter from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office dated October 19, 2017, which also supports what we have just heard, the opposition to commuting the sentence. So just wanted to put that on record. Anyone else from the victim side wishes to speak at this time? Anyone else? Victim side? Anyone else? No. To see anyone else after inquiring three times? At this time, board members, before we go further, do we have any questions at this time for Mr. Vail? Okay, I hear no questions at this time for Mr. Vail. Mr. Vail, we're coming towards the end of your hearing, sir. This is your hearing. We want to give you an opportunity to make a final statement to the board on your behalf. We do ask that you not repeat yourself. And following your statement, the board will go into discussion right here. You can look, see, and hear, and make its decision for today. Mr. Vail, anything else you want to tell the board at this time, sir?
I would like to tell the board, sir, that I'm truly sorry for the actions that I caused on that night. I take full responsibility. I acted alone. My victim did nothing wrong, and she did not deserve what happened to her that night. But I am no more the same person as a kid that I am now as a grown man. I do not think the same. I do not act the same. I understand what I did was terribly wrong. But to think as a 14-year-old kid and to be a 30, 33 in a week, man, understand the pain that I have caused to my victim and why they still may feel the same way, but I am not that same person. And I hope the board can find mercy and what I'm trying to explain, and I truly, to my victim, I truly apologize, and I take full responsibility, and I apologize for the actions that my father may have took, but all blame falls on me, and I take responsibility for that. Thank you to the board.
Thank you so very much, sir. At this time, the board is going into discussion. Mason, if we're talking to you, if we're talking to others in the room at this time, but we're not. We're just talking among ourselves at this time. Following this discussion, the board will make a determination. As I've indicated earlier, that the board does operate under the open meeting laws of the state of Arizona. We do not retire to a room. Whatever discussion we have will be conducted right here at this time. We also do not discuss the case in advance. This will be the first time that the board members present today will have had an opportunity to discuss this case. The board will now go into discussion. We're going to ask everyone to remain quiet. The board will make its determination known after this discussion. And I'm going to reemphasize, I know that this is emotional, but we're going to ask that everyone would remain calm when the board makes its decision. Thank you. Again, I'm just going to say it once again, when we exit those supporters of Mr. Vail, this door, victims, this door. Thank you. Board is now in discussion. Any board member wishes to lead off the discussion? The Honorable Mr. Gowatz, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Board Chairman. I'll try to keep it short. Due to the serious and heinous nature of this crime, as one voting board member, I believe that the release of Mr. Vail would not further the interest of justice, nor be consistent with the welfare of the community that is based on escalating violent behavior leading to the instant offense, despite his age, and escalating violent infractions in DOC through 2014, that is up to the age of 29. As an unvoting board member, I believe that not many 13-year-olds from dysfunctional households, even with the presence of alcohol, drugs, breaking the households, and sexually assault other human beings. I would like to add that Mr. Vail will be 37 years old when he's eligible for release, and I believe he received a lenient sentence, and that's where I'd like to begin the discussion.
Thank you so much, sir. Honorable Mr. Johnson.
Dr. Wright, I do have to take into consideration that this young man was 14 years old when this incident actually occurred. It was a heinous crime that was inflicted upon the on the victim. One of the reasons why I wanted to ask what was going through his mind at that time, that is, his actions are certainly not the actions of your average 14-year-old kid to be sexually active or sexually involved to the degree of a sexual assault to of that degree that actually had occurred in that time. There had been several periods during that time that there were some violent behavior, but I think that Mr. Vail, although being 14 years old, because of his background, because of some family situations, that at 14 years old, Mr. Vail was acting as an adult. And even the victim was shocked to realize that the assailant was so young that committed this act. And I think that the intent and the full knowledge of committing this crime was there. There was several different counts of sexual assault that occurred, and in the plea agreement, he had the maximum for one count of sexual assault and maximum for kidnapping, but I think there were about four counts of sexual assault that was there. Those counts were actually dismissed, and I would hope that Mr. Bell would take the remainder of the time that he has left to really do some soul searching and get involved in some sexual classes and figure out what his triggers are, and hopefully that when he is finally released, that he's able to get out and be a productive citizen and understand he's remorseful for his actions, but I think there's another step where he has to be understanding of what causes those actions, what triggers those actions to actually happen. I am not supportive of granting a phase two commutation and, to pass it on to the governor.
Thank you so much, Honorable Mr. Johnson. My statement should be very brief. As a board member, we have to take everything under consideration. We have to look at the offender. We also have to look at the victim. We also have to look at what is in the best interest of the citizens. As one board member, depending upon a case, I do believe in grace. I do believe in mercy. However, when we have an offense such as we have this morning before this board, I must admit that I do not see a recommendation going to the governor. Just a couple of reasons why I do not. One is he admits himself, he's had no sexual education or training, treatment. And repeating what's already been said, that's a very important step to identify the triggers that resulted in this happening, although he was only 14 years of age. I also would point out the fact that his behavior while being incarcerated, not recently, but 14 is not too long ago, 16 is just 2 years ago, by being incarcerated, shows that he has not matured enough to understand and to obey the laws, the policies of the Department of Corrections. And I just don't believe at this time that he is ready to be that productive citizen that we're looking for in our community. We have no evidence to suggest that he is, except for his word, but we need him to show more interest and that he understands what it means to be a productive citizen. With that being said, if there's no further discussion by board members, yes, Honorable Mr. Gowanus.
Yes, Doctor, I just wanted to make a quick apology. When I set my pen down, I figured there's a microphone up here and it sounded pretty loud. I did not mean to do that for effect. So thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you, sir. If there's nothing else, then I'm going to move very simple, not to recommend to the governor for Mr. Christopher Vail, ADC number 152882. And that is my motion.
Second.
Agreed. Motion by Wright, seconded by Mr. Gowanus, agreed by Mr. Johnson. The recommendation would not be going to the governor. Thank you, and the hearing is open.